Okay. So I was last weekend I was in Utah and I have this like BYU magnet on my van and nobody ever says anything in Orange County about it. But also I'm in Salt Lake and people are like flipping me off and pouring beer on my mom. And I realized, oh man, this is I forgot I had the BYU magnets on my car. So it's kind of nice to be back in Orange County, and you can be a BYU fan in like, relative obscurity, right? So background on me, I went to BYU law school and then and worked in New York City at one of the big firms. And actually, look, I don't ever do court appearances. I don't have the constitution for it. So you litigators, I appreciate you. I can't do it. It's like so much hostility, right? Is mic on? Is everything? Or is it? Okay, so the mic is just to record, not to amplify, which that's good because, yeah. Last time I was on a podcast, they like cut my speed in half because I talked too fast. So then when you listen to it straight, it was like, rah, or maybe normal, but to me it sounded like it was really slow. So what happened? So I went to BYU Law School. And convinced my wife to not do a PhD at Northwestern, but to in fact go to law school with me so she could stay and marry me, and she did. So that was like I hit the lottery there. And now she's a lawyer too, and she actually worked with Blaine for a long time, so she does estate planning. And actually, Blaine, love you to jump in because one thing we're not going to address is the estate planning aspect of succession, right? Because that's you got to plan for that as well. So if jump in if you can. And JB, you talk about you do a lot of real estate deals. A lot of times a real estate will be a separate asset within an acquisition because you can do a lot of different interesting stuff with real estate. We're not really going to discuss that. So then I did a startup. I did a mining startup. So we were mining and a geology and exploration company. And it failed. When you're yeah, it was a really long, complicated situation, but it ended up failing because and so our team, our little team, we kind of were it actually hasn't failed yet, but it's still out there. I still have some amazing shares that wallpaper my room, but basically what ended up happening, sometimes there's political risk, so some local like I guess you could say cartel or pirate, whatever you want to say, got the local townspeople to basically hijack the gold. That when we finally got the gold out of the ground, all of a sudden, like our employees stole the gold from us, and basically gave it to some outside organizations. So, yeah, criminal enterprises. Anyway, so there's a lot of risk with businesses. So then after that, I went and got a tax LLM at UCLA. And then just immediately went in and did securities law. So I am actually not licensed in California. I'm licensed in New York. California is a federal, or securities law is a federal practice generally. There's a few little state securities issues, but there was a statute that basically made it all federal. So that's what I practice under. My M&A stuff. We have four attorneys that are licensed in California at my firm, but we're generally doing things that are just federal securities law. So it's actually nice for attorneys who refer work to me because I'm never going to steal their clients because we can just do the one federal securities piece. So it's been working out pretty good. And then I teach securities regulation at USC, and I teach seminary, which is why I usually can't come to these meetings. So, and I, if, yeah, seminary is a tough one. So there's some pictures of me. Yeah, BYU guy. Anyway, so talk about flipping a business, right? Here's one thing that you got to remember. Oh, and you know what? Let's start passing these handouts out. You want to just kind of, you think so. So one thing you got to remember about a business is that ultimately, what are you selling? Like a lot of people start a business and they think, oh, I got this widget and we're selling these widgets and oh my gosh, this is great or whatever. Like I'm selling my customer base, my client list, my brand, I'm selling my trademark. And you are, but But you're also selling your shares, generally, right? Sometimes you're selling assets, but you're really generally selling your shares. So that means that your like corporate compliance has got to be kind of in order. You have to have like an entity. You've got to like maintain that entity. One other thing is like the IRS. Whenever you have a super successful situation, the IRS always gets involved and tries to extract their piece. Lately, with a lot of tech entrepreneurs, there's been challenges because they're saying like, you didn't actually invest. You had a lifestyle business. You created like you were giving your. You should be getting a salary. You should be getting taxed at ordinary income and not as you know long-term capital gains. So that can be like an 18% swing. It basically doubles the IRS take. And so there's this like my entire stupid LLM degree. All I learned was that you got to make an initial capital contribution and document it when you start a company. Right. Even like, you know, your lawyer's fees usually count, you know, $10,000-$20,000. Like most founders are putting money into the business when they start. They just don't record it and they don't think about how much money they're putting in. Go ahead. Oh, you're the tax guy, right? Oh, man. Okay.
Would inventory count as that?
If you buy inventory, yeah. And then you contribute that inventory. And yeah, raw materials count. You know what else counts? Actually, the IRS has like a revenue ruling. Business plans can count. Client lists can count as an asset. So if you if somebody doesn't have any money and everything like that, then I say sit down for a week, write down a business plan. Use like I like liveplan.com. It's a $10 a month subscription, and they won't charge you until you hit the 30th day. And dude, if you can't write a business plan in 30 days, like ugh. And I'm telling you, like, so many entrepreneurs cannot. Like, they're not like, oh my, and I'm just not a writer. And like, oh man, they can't, you know. And if you or someone on your team like can't write down a business plan, I mean, it severely limits your company's value. Go ahead. Yeah, you're fine.
Classic example then of somebody who would incur that 18% spike because they really didn't put any money.
Yeah, like software developer, right? They're coming in, they're creating this like software. They're not like the software doesn't get actually created for many months. And so it looks like they have a job. It looks like they didn't make an investment, that they just had a job. It should be paid ordinary income, right? Now these cases are kind of interesting. There was a tax guy here last month. I was hoping that I could make him talk at this point, but no, okay. Anyway, so yeah, the software developers, people who are not making a documented initial capital contribution. So go ahead.
Did you document it where paying yourself kind of like in kind? Put on development, paying yourself hours?
So what you want to do.
I'm donating my time to the pet.
No, that's the thing, is the time doesn't count. That's the issue. That's what the IRS position is time doesn't count as an investment, right? So look, I mean, am I going to say this? But I'm going to say this. You know, your lawyer can help you with this stuff. Yeah, you know, there's privilege. But this is not the kind of thing, like basically what the lawyer will do is you go in and you look at your bank statement around the time you filed the company and made it, and then you basically will put down, you'll basically like figure out some initial capital contribution, and you'll make it legitimate. You'll just document it later and then sign it. Anyway, there's also, here's another thing, guys. A lot of people talk about, but I started the business in like March 2018. We just didn't incorporate until September. How can I count my stuff that I invest in March in September when we actually formed the company? You totally can. It's called the law. You guys, all the bar people, all the people who took the bar exam, the law, the doctrine of pre-incorporation promotion, right? Basically, the company can adopt and ratify actions that promoters or founders who started actions before, you know, before the company was actually formed, they can adopt and ratify those actions at the inception of the company. This also applies in employment law, I think. I remember, like, if so, let's say in March you start, you hire some employees, and you break all sorts of labor laws. You can actually, like, I mean, right?
Don't do that.
Right. I'm just saying, you know. So just, you know, because okay, so, I mean, I'm just saying you can, you, what I'm saying is you can still, you know, create liability on behalf of the company before it's even formed, right? Employment liability or otherwise. It works the other way, too. You can ratify the actions. So, look, there's really a lot of, so the reason I like this graphic is because let's say you're not going to go public. Let's say you're not even going to get a seed round or Series A. A lot of this is a this is like a life cycle of a corporation, and there's some typos in here. Ana Vital, we love you. But it's a really cool infographic, I think. And the idea is that a lot of the companies go through these stages and will have an exit strategy or a merger or acquisition along one of these, along part of this life cycle. They don't always go in. Then also, after the IPO, maybe you'll have your merger or exit strategy after the IPO, right? The board will come up and decide to sell the company to a much bigger company. We'll talk about like Instagram, Facebook later on. We'll give you some examples. So, so let's look at this little chart, right? You start the company. You realize I need a software developer, which is pretty much how it goes. So you get some software developer, and you know, most of my clients like will have they're not living in the same town a lot of times, you know, and developers, are there any developers here? Because I'm about to throw down. It's like work. We will do sometimes like film projects where like you'll have like a diva actor that makes you like drive out to the airport and sign a contract on your back, like they love that, right? Or I'm telling you, the good developers are like that too. Like they want to go out on a stage and get applause. And so I've had companies like try to acquire developers, and they'll like fly them to Vegas on a private jet and like arrange like a group of, you know, paid actors to like, you know, to do a kind of a presentation like this, and they're all like cheering and happy, and then they go to the Hakkasan and spend $60,000 per table on, you know, bottles of Dom, like whatever. It's crazy. Anyway, like I've seen developers like basically be like celebrity DJs or something. So you will need a developer. Hopefully you get one that you don't have to do all those things I talked about. But software developers they're tough to work with. Sometimes they change the product. Other times, they make your company. If you get the right developer co-founder, I mean, it's like you're on easy street, because they will basically like incorporate and think of all these interesting new things to incorporate into technology or application. And man, it's almost like you did nothing, right? So anyway, co-founders will get 50%. Then you're going to need some capital. So Uncle comes in on the third one here. Puts in 5%, right? $15,000. No, usually we'd do a little more. I'd probably try to get you to have more than 15% or more than $15,000 for 5%. The other thing is you're going to create a stock option plan. Like this is a really useful thing for a tech company, because you're bootstrapping. You're trying to get other developers to come on, and coders and things like that. And you want to pay them in shares instead of cash, because you don't have any cash. All you have is $15,000 from your uncle at this point. Usually that'd be more like 150 or 200. Anyway, then you have a seed round, and usually this $200,000 is more like, I don't know, 800 to 2 million. But the seed round guy is going to come in. They're going to be an angel. They're going to get 16.7%. They're basically going to get 20%, but once you lump it in, the post valuation percentage is 16.7%. Right? So then you're having a Series A or private equity round, whatever, or venture capital round. They're going to put in $4 million. Or $2 million. They're going to have a $4 million valuation, and you know, then eventually you can go public. So let's just kind of keep like breaking this down a little more. So at the idea stage, you own 100%, right? And by the way, so you create your documents. I'm going to go back to here. Slide center, show and presenter view tips. Don't keep going back and forth is what it says. That's funny. So the thing is, here you're going to have an entity, and you're probably going to want to do a legal Zoom thing. You're still going to want to do a legal Zoom thing. You're still going to want to, I'm not telling you to do legal Zoom. I'm just saying that's what you're going to want to do, because you're going to come to one of us, and we're going to say it's like $1,500 to $2,500 to form your LLC, and you're going to like kind of, I don't want to do that right now, because you only have $15,000. It's exaggeration. But here, your operating agreements and founding documents are going to get completely restructured, because your sophisticated investor is going to come in and they're going to do it all. And then they're going to say, sign here. And they're going to give you 15 minutes to look at it without your lawyer, right? And you're not, and you're going to think you have no other option. You're going to sign there, and all of a sudden, like, you know, I had a one guy develop a software app where you, like, 10 years ago, you point your app at a building, and it tells you, like, gives you all the title history, gives you, like, all, it was a really interesting app, and it started getting really big in New York City, and they were probably netting, I don't know, $6 million a year, something like that. It was this huge, huge app. A lot of professionals were using it, and it had a really high price. Anyway, early on in the stage, he needed $400,000. So he gets some farmer from Iowa. I don't know how he found him. He came to me afterwards. He gets some farmer from Iowa, and they put in $400,000. And the way that the paperwork, their attorney, like, I don't know if their attorney was from New York or Silicon Valley or something, but it was one of these, like, you know, slickster guys, and structures it so that essentially the $400,000 investor gets like 70% of the company, right? And then, you know, they have these forced capital contributions. They say, okay, we need $100,000 this month. So founder, who's the developer, and us, we're all going to contribute money this month. And if you don't, then you're going to get your percentage of ownership taken down. So suddenly, you know, the Iowa farmer guy's at like 88%. My guy's at 12%. And he's like, I've done everything. The Iowa guy has like done nothing. And, you know, they keep, and we have all this money in the bank, and they keep doing these initial, these forced capital contributions that I can't make. And they know I can't make. Anyway, whole thing, huge problem. They restructured the documents, and these guys didn't have enough money for an attorney, and so that happens here. These guys will restructure the documents again, and then here we will restructure the documents again. I'm talking about sometimes like creating additional classes of stock, you know, so you're going to want to, like, if we have a very simple business and you don't anticipate tremendous amounts of growth, what I like to do is, let's say you, so there's an authorized amount of shares and then an issued amount of shares. So the authorized amount of shares is like the company's bank vault, and that's their shares. Let's say you authorize 10 million shares. I like to do this, right? And then we'll issue the founders 5.1 million shares at the outset, because they'll be forced to always have 51%. And then when at this stage the investors try to increase the authorized amount to 100 million so that, you know, they could potentially dilute your ownership tremendously later on, they can't increase the authorized amount without your vote. They won't ever be able to do it, and you'll always have the majority vote. So it protects you a little bit. That structure, I don't like to do if you're planning on going public. That's only if you're planning on being private. And we should probably talk about the type of private businesses that there are. There's really, like, our industry, we talk about two different kinds of businesses. One is a lifestyle business. A lifestyle business is a business where the CEO started the company, loves running it, doesn't ever want to leave. You know, they talked about, you know, he'll come in at 10 and leave at 3 sometimes. Like, that's a, you know, lifestyle business. It's a comfortable income. It's stable, but it's not a growth company. Now, if you have that kind of business, great. And also great, because those businesses tend to tend to be able to, so like if I'm going to acquire a lifestyle business that's able to be acquired, sometimes the lifestyle business, that founder is completely the business. And so you really can't acquire that business. But if I'm going to acquire a lifestyle business, I know that there's a lot of untapped potential in that business. Because that founder could work a lot harder, could really ramp up things a lot more. This, I'm talking generals. There are a lot of examples that are contradicting me. But, you know, lifestyle businesses are great, but sometimes you won't get a very good price for a lifestyle business. And when you do, another thing to consider is that when somebody buys your business, you're going to have an 18-month to 2-year, maybe 3-year, like employment contract after that, where you've got to work the business for another 18 months to 3 years, depending on how the negotiations go, depending how essential you are to the business. So, you know, sometimes you think you have the cash. So it's really frustrating for the people that sell because they just got $10 million and they still have to work, but they're working at like a normal salary. So, you know, they'll get like $150,000 a year for 3 years. And meanwhile, they're like dying to go to, you know, live in Bali or whatever. So, lifestyle businesses, so if you can, you know, when you're getting ready to prepare, start ramping up your operations, and that will, you know, increase the value of your business when you actually do sell. So, all right. Now, there's also a bunch of like business broker type people that'll help you find buyers. It's a super unregulated industry. Investment banks will often like help you find buyers, and they'll take, you know, 10 to 15% of the actual acquisition value. A lot of my clients have been very frustrated when the investment bank gets such a big percentage of the company. They'll say things like, I got an aerospace company sell, and the investment bank got like 12 to 15%. And they were super frustrated because they were like, I spent 40 years building this business. And these guys, like, for 4 months of work, got 15%. You know, and like my employees who, you know, for 10 years have been, you know, working their hearts out, they only got 5%. So it does seem really frustrating when the investment bank does that. However, I have seen the investment bank increase the value by 30 to 40% sometimes. And so, you know, it's all relative, and it seems like a big chunk, but they probably wouldn't have sold for as much as they did without that bank. Now, what does the investment bank do? What is the magic sauce for your business? And I know I'm going out of order. Dang, I'm the worst at this. I'm terrible at this. Okay. The magic sauce for your business is financial accounting. Like, you've got to have financial accounting. You've got, like, and I'm not talking about QuickBooks. Like, you've got to have more than QuickBooks. You've got to have some analysis and financial statements that you can actually analyze. Like, I've seen this client in South Bend, Indiana, and there was a competing company in Chicago. The Chicago company when the snow comes and then the big plows come, that's got a name, but they had like plow, they were like plow cities. And they plow in the winter and landscape in the summer, and they get these big city contracts. And so there's this bigger company in Chicago, smaller company in South Bend, Indiana. The South Bend, Indiana company was run by an accountant. And so he was like, loved doing his books. He like loved it. And he loved like, you know, doing like getting financial valuation. And he just like loved all the reporting and stuff like that. Well, when they both sold to the same company that went in and swept them all up, and they just went through the Midwest. I guess there was this like salt shortage a few years ago. You guys might know more about this than I do. But like, because there was a salt shortage, then this company that like had a bunch of salt could like charge a premium for it if they had these like these. Anyways, this really is interesting. They call it a roll-up transaction, where they go and they buy a bunch of smaller businesses in one particular industry. Anyway, so we represented we had a piece of that deal, and what we found was the little South Bend, Indiana company that had tons of financial reporting sold for almost as much as the Chicago company that had hardly any financial reporting but was like nearly double the size. They got almost identical purchase prices, and the difference is that the acquiring company could evaluate the South Bend, Indiana company better. And to the extent they couldn't evaluate the company in Chicago, they saw it as a risk. And they discounted the company based on that risk severely. And so if the Chicago company had spent $40,000 more on accountants, they could have gotten like $2 million more in value. So I think that's like an example of why you want to have like accountants. And I know that everyone's scared of hiring lawyers, but accountants are like, whew, that's tough. I mean, going through every single transaction. Another thing is you got to try to separate your like, don't run everything through the business, right? You don't want to, we did a sale of a business, it was like a managed care company. If you want, like, have a business, pay a consulting company, and then run all your personal crap through that consulting company that pays you, right? Do that instead of like running everything through the business. So we had this like managed healthcare company in Seattle or something in 2011. It was a long time ago. And when they sold the business, there were five partners. All of their personal vehicles had to go with the company. And so like all of a sudden they had no cars, and they had like, all, I mean, it was just the funniest thing. Like their wife had to like give up her Audi, and she was like super ticked off, right? Because all the partners were running all their cars through the business, and that was their assets. And so the company got the assets. It was really and what happened in this particular case, and I don't think it was a lack of financial reporting, but you know, there was a fair amount of risk in the deal, and so the acquiring company was like, look, that's like $250,000 of assets, like, that's more physical, tangible property that we can get. Like, they wanted to include it. So another time, and then we had another really interesting oil company, and they separated out their real estate. This happens also with like, oh man, my partner had a deal where it was like an elderly facility, elderly care facility. And they sold the business, but kept the real estate, and then did like a lease. I forgot your name. What's your name?
Ken.
We're back here. Yeah.
Mike.
And what do you do? You're the tax guy. Perfect. Okay. I was talking about you. I was like, last month there was this tax attorney guy, and I was okay. So I'm gonna bug you. I'm gonna get you to opine on some things. Not officially opine with like where you bring your malpractice insurance. No. Just maybe contribute. I'll have you contribute, okay? Because we actually have some like tax issues that we need to work through with in context of a acquisition and sale of a business. All right. So when you're raising money, okay. All right. If you take nothing else from this lecture, when you're getting funding from people, like, this process is highly regulated. Because after the stock market crash of 1929, Congress decided that we didn't have strict enough securities laws, because there were tons of securities raises. People were selling stock to everyone. It was completely unregulated. And so, you know, the big swing was the 1933 and 34 Securities Acts, right? And that basically created the stock market as we know it today, where it's highly regulated. Okay, and eventually what we derived from those acts was, one, you have to tell people what kind of stock they're investing in. Two, you have to get accredited investors. Accredited investors, otherwise what we call in the industry is fat cats, right? They come in and they have $1 million of annual of wealth, right, of their personal worth, excluding their personal residence. You can't, so like in like, I don't know, 2012 or something, they excluded personal residences because everyone in California was claiming to be accredited, because every house is $1 million here. And come on, if it's not, you still pretty much believe your house is worth $1 million in Southern California. So you know what I'm talking about. I do that too. So It's a feel that mortgage payment feels like a million. Anyway, so either that or you have a $200,000 to $250,000 annual income. That puts you into an accredited investor category. And the criticism with this is that basically rich people, only rich people can get richer. That's like the political argument that's going on right now. And in response to that, Congress created, I mean, I'm sort of super generalizing, but in response to that concept that only accredited rich people can invest in these private companies and get richer, you know, in there was this big movement where they created things like IRAs, 401k programs, ESOPs, which is employee stock ownership plans. That was all created, like a lot of those plans were created by like liberals, right? Because they were trying to get like stock and security ownership to the masses. Pretty interesting debates that happened in the 70s about this stuff. But that's how your stock option plan that we talked about earlier on, where you can pay your developers in stock options, that's sort of the genesis of how those things started. Because otherwise, it was only the truly wealthy who were getting shares in companies. Or you know, investing in the stock market. So, yeah.
Before you go on, so accredited investor, and then you get this friends and family.
Yeah.
Family is kind of a relatively provable thing. How do you what constitutes friend versus, like, so over here you can accept money from a friend.
Yeah.
Right? And that friend does not have to be an accredited investor.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
No. So that's why I was like, that's why I started to push over. The idea is this: your early round private investors, they all have to be friends or family. You have to have a pre-existing substantive relationship with them in order to offer them securities. And the only time you can offer unaccredited investors securities is if you have audited your financial statements. I know, the SEC is like, wow, they're crazy. Because nobody audits their financial statements. Everybody takes friends and family, unaccredited friends and family, and it's like a nightmare when we get in, and it sucks. But it, you know, and private equity firms and venture capital firms love when you have friends and family in your cap table. Because then they're like, you are going to like be all in. Because you're going to let everybody down. In the meantime, they kind of broke securities laws doing that, right? So, I know. Go ahead.
Your rich uncle has $10 million in the bank.
Oh, yeah.
Is he ineligible to be one of your seminal investors?
Totally eligible to do it. He still can, absolutely. Actually, when you get 10, so there are different levels of investors. There's accredited, and then there's QIBs, qualified institutional buyers, and those people have more than $10 million. And so that vaults them into a different category. In fact, with a QIB, I mean, a lot of the case law suggests they need no documentation at all. Like, you can't, like, actively defraud them and get their money. But they are basically, you know, if they invest in a small company and then try to sue because, and they can't prove, like, intent to defraud, they're often going to lose because they're going to be like, you knew better. You had $10 million. You're an essentially qualified institutional buyer. They have less protections. The less sophisticated an investor is, the more often they can sue you and win. So I guess the idea is this, is that the reason why you want to really steer clear from unaccredited, unsophisticated family members is because they will crush you in court. There's a lot of laws designed to protect people like that. And it's interesting because, oh man, we're going to get into this theory. I love this stuff. But they've done a bunch of sociological studies and psychological studies, and they've found that accredited investors are far more likely to read the disclosure materials you're supposed to give somebody in an investment context. And unaccredited investors are far less likely to read the disclosure materials that you're giving them in the context of investment. However, you're actually basically all like really largely required to give the investment materials to unaccredited investors who are far less likely to read them than you are to accredited investors who are more likely to read them. we're doing our best we can in the old US of A, but we're really struggling in this area. So as you've seen with the whole, like, you know, Kickstarter debacle, where they started equity crowdfunding in, what, 2009, and it went nuts. And everybody, it showed that it was a real, real interesting thing, and then they took it away because the SEC came in and shut that down. And then, like, Congress, Patrick Henry, it was this, like, congressman in North Carolina. Oh, by the way, what time do I go to? Because I'm about to go real fun about this crowdfunding stuff. 8:20?
20.
Okay, perfect. So, okay, we got plenty of time. Anyways, with Patrick Henry in North Carolina or South Carolina, he, like, created this, like, these rules to actually legitimate equity crowdfunding. And then the SEC came in and said, over my dead body, literally two commissioners resigned because they didn't want to see crowdfunding hit the streets. Finally, the third commissioner took the helm and made the laws so crazy hard to deal with that now it's dead on arrival. Nobody's raising money through crowdfunding. It's really sad. But this is the Jobs Act I'm talking about. The rules promulgated under the Jobs Act. I mean, if you look at some of the equity crowdfunding websites that are happening, they're dead. They're not really happening. To unaccredited investors, there's another piece called 506C where you can generally advertise to the public for your securities, but only accredited investors who are verified can invest. That's alive and well, and that actually was a game changer. Versus, yeah, 506B, yeah. So, yeah, wow, hey, whoa, we should go to lunch. No, yeah, this is...
is it sufficient? Don't a lot of those sites just have to check the box if you're accredited?
No, that's a 506B. 506B, you just have to check the box. If the investor represents that they are accredited, beautiful. But you can't generally solicit in that context. You can't, like, have radio advertisements. You can't have internet advertisements. You know,
all you can do basically say is you have a great deal that you'd like to get them involved in, but you got to basically build a relationship with them.
Or you technically have to have already had a relationship with them, or your, you know, people on your board or something had a relationship with them. Documenting that, like, pre-existing substantial, I mean, you're rarely called on to document it. Like, generally, when you have an accredited investor, we do a lot of investigations, so we see how it works on the SEC side. They generally don't force you to, like, prove that you had a pre-existing relationship, because that's really hard. Yeah. You know, they don't want to do anything hard over there. So, yeah, the other thing that's really hard is to establish criminal intent to defraud. Really hard. I mean, oh, man. And every time we get a client that's going to raise money, like, we do the best we can to make sure it's a real company, real product. But, like, sometimes we've gotten tricked too, right? So, yeah, talk about a scary practice area. Okay, so seed rounds. Okay, so here's the outcomes of the initial raises, right? You run out of funding and nobody wants to invest. Company dies, like my mining company. It's not dead yet, though, but I'm still holding out hope, you know, for my shares. Number two, you get enough funding to build something, or a bigger company wants to buy you, get acquired, or you combine forces and you do a merger. Or you go public. And going public, the concept of going public, we're not going to talk about it for that long. The idea is that you, what we call in the industry, take some cards off the table. There's, like, so many, like, weird Wall Street slings. But the idea is that you give up some of your ownership percentage in exchange for some cash, right? But it's not like you're cashing out on day one of your IPO. On your IPO, you're selling to individuals. You want to spread your shares around so that there's buying and selling, so that you get volume in the stock market. Once you get volume, then you can start to leak out your shares as a founder. Often, you know, before that, some of these series rounds, they're going to come in and they're going to want to buy founder shares and the company's bank shares, right? Like the authorized shares. Sometimes they'll want the founder shares because they can dilute that founder more quickly, right? They don't want this hulking, you know, 58% Mark Zuckerberg in there, right? He's down to what, 12% now? Still by far the largest shareholder. He's done a really good job maintaining control, and I think he has these super voting shares, so he can still vote everything in. But yeah, 12% is where he's at. And I think, let's look at this one. Founders are at 17.5% each at the IPO. That's pretty darn good. So, but when I, like, talk to my people that want to go public, and I kind of say you're probably going to be in the 20% range by the end, that's like a deal breaker for them. Like, oh, I want to be a 90%. I'm like, well, but then you want to be volume. Like, oh, we'll get the volume. We have such a great company. Oh, man. Anyway. So, and then they'll go to someone else who, like, just gives them more hope than I do. And it sucks. And then they call me back and be like, oh, okay, we're public and it's a nightmare. We want you to represent us. Anyway, sorry. Okay, so the acquisition. Let's talk about, like, asset purchase and stock purchase, right? Because there's a difference in tax, right? The acquiring company always wants to buy your assets. You always want to sell your stock. You know what I mean? You sell your stock because then they get even though you can sort of mitigate it through the agreement, they get a lot of the liabilities that come with it, right? And also, you can do more interesting things from a tax perspective when you sell stock. You can, anyway, asset purchases, the acquiring company can do some pretty interesting things too. So that we'll deal with that later, and I don't really think we have. Anyway, sometimes, we want to talk about hostile takeovers, but I only have 10 minutes. But the Pac-Man defense and poison pills are so fun to talk about. Let's do it later. Another time. We'll do another presentation later. And then we also have these things called spin-offs, right? So here's something interesting. Because before you sell your business, sometimes you have a business that actually has two products inside of it, right? The two products that you have inside of it, the acquiring company only wants one. So you're a designer, right? So you say that you have like a healthcare side, right? And then what's your other side? A corporate design side, right? So let's say when you were gonna sell your company, you might consider spinning off the healthcare design firm into another entity. I mean, let's assume that it doesn't violate your non-compete, right? You sell your corporate design space, and then you spin off your healthcare design concept, and then you get some sort of waiver from them that they won't consider your healthcare design a competing company, and then you go on and you do that. Like, you may want to do something like that. And a lot of businesses would consider something like that, where they would do a spin-off transaction where they separate out the assets or the business lines, sell the one, and either maintain the other or sell that to someone else, right? So you do a double sale. That might be an interesting concept for you to do. Yeah. 10 minutes. Let's get into some examples. So, oh man, I love this example. So there was this Belarusian immigrant, Rose Blumkin, right? I don't know if anyone knows this story. It's such a fun story. But her husband had like a store that did like secondhand sales, kind of like a DI, right? So secondhand sales store, and they wanted to recarpet their house. So they went to a city, like, you know, three or four cities over, and they found like a wholesale seller. And they said, we will only sell to you if you are a legitimate, like, furniture store, right? And so they said, we are. We have this, like, furniture store in Omaha, right? And basically the way it worked is they said, we have this furniture store in Omaha. It's also, you know, a secondhand used store, but, you know, they basically convinced this wholesaler that they were a legitimate furniture mart. And so they called it Nebraska Furniture Mart or something like that. They, like, incorporated real quick, went over, showed them the docs, and then bought more carpet than they're like, here's what we'll do. Because we want to carpet our house for free. So they bought, like, a bunch more carpet than they needed and then lined up people to also carpet their home, and then they marked the price up 10%. Okay, so it worked out for their home, like, really well. They had a lot of people buy this carpet. So then they bring it back to Omaha. They carpet all their houses, and like, wow, we actually did pretty good. So then they went back to the carpet store and bought more carpet, put it in this used, like, little mart, and then started selling, and then they found an abandoned building and like filled it with carpet, you know. They just kind of borrowed it for a little while. It was like this haunted mansion thing. Anyway, really interesting. Whoa, what just happened? Okay, all right. So they found this like abandoned building, and they used it just for a couple of months until they got like a real, you know, big warehouse. And they basically were selling everything at 10% markup, and that's it. And they started like making pretty good money. Everyone else is selling at a 40% markup, so this was a significant discount to everyone in the area. So then, in 1937, they opened a business, the Basement of Her Husband's Store. Larger competitors started to notice them. And then they went out and got all their suppliers to stop selling to them. So the Blumkins sued based on monopoly rules, right? The anti-competition rules and stuff like that. The judge ruled in the Blumkins' favor. Later that afternoon, went to their store and bought new carpet for his house. So, super exciting business. Then they like blew up, and they were huge, and tons of competitors tried to buy them. And when they never would buy them, they never had good financial accounting. And so all the competitors got scared away because they really didn't know what they were buying. They couldn't evaluate the business. So then Warren Buffett, right? Warren Buffett goes in, and what he does, because he knows they don't have any financial accounting and they won't prepare it, and so all of his lawyers and advisors are saying, don't buy it. You don't even know what you're buying. You have no idea what they have. So he asked for bank statements, and then they had this like one-page contract, which is not usual. They had this one-page contract, and then what Warren Buffett did is he stuck a bunch of his people in the store for a couple weeks, and they just like looked and viewed to see how many people were buying and what they were buying and if the registers were like giving bigger discounts than they thought. And they would like take, at the end of the day, they would like, you know, get copies of the receipts, and they like basically took a snapshot of a 2 to 3 week period, and that's how they did their valuation, their due diligence and analysis on the company. Now, that is like such a rare occurrence, and it's probably not going to happen to you. Like literally 50 years later, we're talking about this instance and how rare it is. So you're probably going to need good financial accounting, right, to actually sell your business. But it was a really interesting deal. He loved it, and they were super successful with it. The current store has expanded in Iowa, Kansas, Texas, and they do electronic goods and flooring, stuff like that. Anyway, so, but what happened is they took, essentially when Warren Buffett bought it, they took it public. So that it went into Berkshire Hathaway, and then it became public, and at that point they had to audit their financials. But once he bought it, he could do it. Now, let me tell you why he got burned on the one-page contract. When Rose Blumkin was 98 years old, she got in a dispute with her son and then went across the street and started a competing furniture store. She's 98 years old, competing with her old business and Warren Buffett. Like, oh my gosh. And Warren Buffett was like, wait a minute. Now, if I'm going to ruin the relationship if I take Rose's side, or if I take the son's side, I'm going to ruin those relationships. So what he ended up doing was he bought Rose Blumkin's new store and basically the consideration was a non-compete. And he wanted a non-compete to, like, he did this thing where it was like a, I can't remember how he structured it, but he wanted it to go like 10 years beyond her death or something like that. So it was super interesting stuff. Now, let's also talk about investors in these early deals. So Snapchat, when they were doing their early rounds of investment, you can go look at their Form Ds that they put online. There was this like random private school, like a Catholic private school in Mountain View, and they invested $15,000, I think, in the second round of Snapchat's funding. And by the time of their IPO, they cashed out two-thirds of their investment for $24 million. And it was the banking group that actually cashed them out. So the banking group that came in to you know, set up the IPO, like, usually there were like six or seven investment banks. they asked to cash out 2/3 of their investment for $24 million. And that was at $17, which was the price that the underwriters bought it at, and then they went and sold at $22. Banks. Am I right? What are you going to do? Anyway, but they had, so as essentially their total investment was valued at $34 million on a $15,000 investment. I'm not saying run out and invest $15,000 in every private company you can get your hands on, but I am saying that, you know, this model that a lot of venture capital firms have of doing that, investing in as many private companies as you can, and, you know, nine are going to fail, but that one is going to be so big that it's going to, like, wipe out all your losses. Like, that's literally their model. And so, but because of these kinds of returns, we had another company, a competing mining company that we were working with, and we saw their shares go from something like, I think it was $1.30, and within 5 or 6 years, they got acquired at like $72 a share. Like, it was just insane. They had done a lot of financings and stuff like that. So if you bought it at $1.30, you actually got diluted pretty severely. But, you know, interesting stuff happened. It was a really, you know, really big. These companies have incredible value as you go forward. So, look, we're barely touching on a lot of this stuff. I'm not trying to give anyone legal advice. But, you know, come talk to me if you have any questions. You know, and also if you want to come sit in on my classes at USC, you're all welcome to. Go ahead. So there are, how do you find these private companies is what your question is, right? And there's a bunch of websites now that do the 506C. And so, there's like Seed Invest, there's like, there's so many Angel Invest, like there's so many different like companies where there's private companies raising money on the internet. And they'll have like a stable of companies that are advertising on these websites. And they have all their investment documentation in a row. And the website itself will verify your status as accredited before you can get a login to go in and view all these company investments.
So I could do it
now. As if you're an unaccredited investor, then you could go into a Title III crowdfunding platform, and there's tons of them. There's ones for films. There's ones for, you know, all sorts of different types of investments, and you can invest up to, I think it's $10,000 per year or up to some percentage of your income. And I don't know that they verify with tax. I think you just self-select on those. But, you know, essentially that's a way that unaccredited investors can find investments. Or the public stock market, right? The public market is, you know, another way. Go ahead. Not on like the NASDAQ or the NYSE, but you know, if you can, the trick is finding a good OTC company or pink sheet company that, you know, but you know, be careful, but be careful in all these. If you're not like investing in a blue chip stock, like there's risk. There's also the reward concept.
The crowdfunding thing though, didn't that go away like you said?
No. It's just highly regulated to the point where an unaccredited investor can only invest up to $10,000 a year, or a certain percentage of their net worth, right?
So I know it's different for different industries, but what's the best way for a person to find the business broker, for lack of a better term? Someone who's going to say, okay,
yeah,
I mean, maybe it's not. Maybe my business is, you know, smaller than, so I'm not going to get J.P. Morgan Gold. I'm not going to get one of the investment banks.
Right.
To pay attention. How do I find that? That broker who's in that industry say, yeah, I can take you and find a buyer for your business.
It's so hard. It's so hard. Like, a lot of times what these smaller investment banks do, they'll call themselves merchant banks sometimes. Sometimes they'll call themselves business brokers. You know, sometimes they can, like, give you referrals and you can talk to people, past clients. It's tough. You really got to be wary of people. It's an unregulated industry. You know, sometimes they'll say, all right, we will sell your business, but you got to give us a $20,000 consulting fee up front, and then we'll sell your business. And then they, like, some of them never do any work. I've seen other ones for, you know, $5,000 a month. You think, oh, man, they're never going to do anything. And they actually do perform pretty well. Like, it's really hit and miss. It's hard to tell if you're going to get a good one or a bad one. Some well-credentialed person will come in and be a terrible business broker. And then I've seen, like, other really scrappy, like, no credentials, just, like, get it done. I wish I had a better answer for you on this. It's difficult. Yeah. Well, with that, I think, yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Gil.
Oh, yeah.
That was awesome. A little token of our appreciation.
Awesome. Thank you.
Let's do round two sometime.